Met a ghost of a king on the road when I first fell. Fire burning to my knees, I fell. Met a ghost of a king on the road.
Oh, welcome to the members only SaaS party time.
This is great. And there's only two members so far.
Two members and one of them's ill.
I'm here to play the sinus trombone.
Can't believe I'm in an enclosed space with a sick person.
I'm going to keep the coughing. Luckily, you made me laugh already and then I coughed.
My immune system is intact.
Yeah, I'm like a week into antibiotics, so I'm totally not contagious anymore.
Yeah, as long as it's not a virus, Brian.
Okay, yeah. SaaS episode.
We should just call this the coughing episode.
Yeah, just me.
This spelling. Is in which Brian Cole hacks a lung episode because it's going to be a fantastic episode.
Right, in which everyone thinks, why didn't he stay home? But it's because SaaS matters.
It matters. Okay.
I think most of our listeners were, you know, secretly hoping that your team would not progress to the final championship.
We didn't. We made you all happy.
So that SaaS would start again, but they forgot that you are coaching track.
Yeah, but that's easy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So your team did not win state.
My team did not go to state.
Okay.
We did not successfully go to state. This is the downside of the upside of being in the best league in the state.
Yeah.
So.
The upside is you get to play against the best.
The upside is the best league and it's way more fun and our district tournament's probably more challenging than the state tournament.
Mm-hmm.
But the downside is you don't get to always just drive to Boise. I mean, everybody wants to.
Right.
So hopefully next year we'll get it, but it's, we definitely improved. Last season, the team was 8-14. This year we were 14-9. A lot of growth, a lot of development.
That's great.
We beat the, to kind of give a little perspective on the nature of sports in Idaho, we beat the district champion from the classification above us, who is off to state and will do well at state. And that's kind of the case with a lot of the teams in our league. They, you know, the stronger yeah. teams in our league play all the way up through the classifications and, you know, we're all down to the bottom in 1A,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a surprise that we fourth place, like the mighty fourth place team would defeat the first place team from a, you know, a school that's more than twice our size.
Yeah.
That's just, kind of
that's
par,
cool.
That's par for the course for our league.
That's cool though.
So anyway, it was fun. I was really proud of the guys. It was long. It was arduous. It was dramatic. It was a reality show. It did all the things. It did I know. All the things.
And you're probably happy we didn't film it. I am still sad we did not film it.
No, we could not have.
No, I know.
We could not have.
It would have been as good as Last Dance.
The last time I talked, it would have been pretty good. The last time I talked about it, I did what I always do when we have a podcast, which is we have a conversation in a room that I then forget about and I leave and I go start doing a bunch of work and then it suddenly drops. And so the podcast about our little scandalousness dropped in the midst of the hottest beehive moment. And it was like a week or so later and like state officials were listening to the podcast, and refs and coaches. And it's funny to me because, and some actually were really liked it and some understood it and liked it. Some understood it and didn't like it. And some just didn't understand it.
I think that covers, the quadrant,
which is to be expected. But I will say, it's pretty weird because I am used to the random upset people from Hollywood or New York publishing that I'll hear from.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, I said that. Yeah, I did say that. That is truly my opinion. Yes, I'm sorry. The movie you worked on, you know, was not the beacon of hope and glory that you thought it was. Or the way you've pursued your career for the last 10 years in the industry has not been strategic. Or, you know, fill in the blank on something I said about publishing. This was the first time where people mad at me about basketball because of my podcast. This is not, I mean... Some of you listeners might think it is a basketball podcast because I talk about high school sports way too much. I talk about high school sports way too much on this podcast, but it's not actually a basketball podcast. This was the first time I had people angry at me.
Yeah.
For what I said about basketball.
The real plot twist is we're about to announce our sponsorship by the I HSAA.
Yeah, say it correctly. We're sponsoring the Real Dairy Shootout. We're going to sponsor the state championship. Mm-hmm.
They want SASP to continue, so they're going to get behind the podcast.
Look at Brian being funny. It's weird, though, because the thing is that when people are upset at me about this one, especially, they're most upset about me talking about the deck being rigged against us.
Oh, okay.
You know, and, you know, the whole concept of the city of God, the city of man, you know, which I just referred to Babylon, yeah, which is all about infrastructure, secular infrastructure. There are a ton of people out there who are like actually our brothers and sisters in the kingdom. You know, it's like as far as the infrastructure goes, as far as the county prosecutors go,
yeah,
as far as the secular governmental structures go, we cannot and we should not expect a fair shake.
I saw that quote popping up regularly from last week's or 2 weeks ago episode. People saying, yeah, Babylon, why would we expect Babylon to fight fair? And I think people hear that and can either think that's they immediately put like an overtone of your whining. If they're going to misunderstand you, they think you're like complaining about it as opposed to understanding.
And what I tell the guys is this is preparation for the real world. So if I watch a basketball game between two public schools, you're never going to see refs be perfectly even. You're going to see refs do a good job at on a sliding scale, right?
Right.
You know, it's like sometimes they'll miss this. If you're LeBron,
you get the calls. You get the layup calls.
They're human. So there's going to be different things. Now, what you'll see is also there's a recent local game where reffing wasn't terrible, but it started to be a little bad. And then players laid into the refs about it. And then it went real bad. And the nature of it is the nature of it is just that prejudice is a real thing. We all come with it and we can't. Once we have those glasses on, we can't take them off.
Yeah.
And so I really try to drum, and I've seen this isn't unique to me. I've seen some of the other coaches doing this too. There's just no emotion. There's no reaction. There's no, like, you cannot feed it. You cannot react to it. Because if you do have a bad call, what you would like is to not have another one. You'd like for it to have been a mistake and for it to even out and so on. But you can really like be disrespectful and be a little tick and needle a ref in a way that's going to then put some jaundiced glasses on him. The worst game we had a game first half, really like as even as you can be realistically, 8 fouls called to 9 fouls called, you know, within one, like there's no reason to think there was anything wrong with any of that.
Yeah.
Second half, 19 fouls to 3 fouls.
Mm.
It's like, what happened? It's like, well, okay. One of my players kneed an opponent in the stomach is what happened. One of my players started out with like an inadvertent spaz, but there's no question it was not a basketball move. He got his knee up in the guy's stomach. And it's like, he should have been ejected for it. He wasn't. The ref didn't get a clean look at it. Cautioned both coaches. I didn't see it that night. I review film and I'm like, ooh,
like, that's not a good one.
So I suspend him from the team. You know, he's removed from my team because we don't do that. We don't, however it began, whether it was incidental, whether it was inadvertent at its initiation, it doesn't matter when your knee gets that high and it's the equivalent of a flagrant or an intentional foul and it's an unsafe play, you know. There's going to be consequences, and we are right at the end, but that immediately diffused all of my frustration at the reffing. Like my frustration at the reffing was just gone because it was like, oh, we did that. Like it was 8-9 and then went 19-3 against us in the second half. And right at the end of the first half, this happened. So it's as if we went around and put yellow sunglasses on all the refs.
Yeah, because the refs are like, look, this team is playing dirty.
So, but it's not even intentional. It's not like, I'm not saying that they then plotted to, you know, call more fouls the other direction. They don't have to have done that in order for them to be disinclined to be, you know, to be favorable towards us.
Right.
So when a kid takes a cheap shot, you know, however, and for whatever reason, he takes that cheap shot, it just influences the whole situation. Yeah.
Well, this cracks me up. City League basketball, it's a, you always get to see that. And,
yeah,
you know, in the ultimate, because the refs are worse. The guys are worse. No, and everybody's taking it way too seriously. So you can watch the team that chirps immediately get all the fouls called. Yeah. Just nonstop.
Yep. I've been, and it's kind of funny. My son, last summer, I watched him get ejected from an AAU game. I think I talked about it on this podcast. You know, I watched
our basketball podcast.
Yeah. I watched a ref eject him because of how angry the fans were at him playing 94 feet of defense on this guy. And they were just losing the moms or losing their minds and they're threatening violence. And it got crazy. It was a classic like viral AAU moment that just everything that's wrong with youth sports. And because this is a sports podcast, I will add a little qualifier here. Courtesy of a conversation with a friend, Mr. Darren Doan. It's important to realize for people who are all in on sports that sports sanctify nothing. Sports do not bring any holiness. Sports do not by themselves teach any character. Mm. Like they don't.
I mean, isn't it a little? I thought Paul says it profiteth little.
It profiteth, like you're in better shape.
Okay. All right.
And good. You could be in mentally better shape. Like there's things about it. But if you have the wrong kind of parents putting you into AAU with the wrong kind of coach, it is not. Okay. It's like, oh, that's just not automatically a net positive because it's a sport. It's like it can, you know, it can be like gasoline on a fire of your pre-existing character flaws.
Yeah.
So unless it's actually going to hunt down and exterminate your character flaws via wise parents or a wise coach, it's going to expose those character flaws and provide you with the opportunity to eliminate those character flaws. But it also could just be miracle grow to a weed, you know, just helping that weed, you know, explode. So as much as I love it, as much as I've used it in my own kids' upbringing, all sorts of different sports, it is not by itself benediction.
Like, sure.
Any more than, you know, anything else is alcohol, a gun. It's like, these are things that have to be used with wisdom. So anyway, we did not go to state. State's happening Thursday, kicks off on Thursday. I do have to say, I hope the teams who went from our league really show up and represent well, you know?
Yeah.
I want them to bring home a banner for the whole league.
Right.
You know, prove that we got stuck at home for a reason. we were behind the best.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't want them to choke. They better not choke.
That would be embarrassing.
That would be sad.
No one wants that.
So moving on.
We actually do have a podcast on sport today.
Oh yeah. We're talking some Chariots of Fire.
We're talking Chariots of Fire. We gave you all 2 weeks to rewatch it if you haven't seen it again recently.
And actually, it's a perfect example of what I was talking about. In terms of it's not a benediction by itself.
That's why we waxed long, I think, because
we knew in our bones that it was going to tie in thematically.
Yeah, you can watch the two main characters, and the point of Chariots of Fire is watching your two protagonists. Well, I think that's your interpretation, right? I guess you could watch Chariots of Fire and think Eric Little's the hero, and in another sense, Abraham's. Is operating in a bit of a role of an antagonist who has to come and change. But I think your point is that the story of Chariots of Fire is actually about Harold Abrahams.
Yeah. That's where the resolution is.
That's where the character change comes and the resolution. And you've claimed that opening scene, I think, being the primary key to interpreting Chariots of Fire happening in a Christian church.
Yeah, it's his funeral. They're singing a Christian hymn and they're in a Christian church.
Yeah. Whereas he's Jewish,
not a Christian, and is very touchy about it the whole time. So it's not an accident.
Yeah.
That's where we are.
Well, interesting that, they're singing that
William Blake, Jerusalem.
Yeah. The Jerusalem, the unofficial anthem of the English nation, with that line, the Chariots of Fire, the Blake poem that it comes from. Which I was thinking, oh, hold on. I should have had this pulled up already, but the clip that I had from that line it's very interesting. It's about turning England into kind of a Christian promised land. You know, it's basically
it's very Mormon. Okay. It's like Mormonism and North America, like the, you know, the lost tribes and everything else, but they had this chosen nation, I could sing it, but I won't. I'll tell it while you're looking this up. I'll tell a little story. It's a funny story. Once upon a time, there was a little restaurant that was 24 hours for a while. I think it was 24 hours, but at this point, I don't think it was called The Pantry. It was a diner style restaurant in the front of the local Best Western. And it occasionally got kind of busy at weird moments when all other restaurants were closed and you could still show up at almost midnight and get an omelet or something. There'd be a lot of people there. And forgive me for not remembering its specific hours of operation, but it was, but I don't. So some friends of mine and I thought, let's all go to the pantry. Some busy moment when it's crowded. Let's all sit all over the restaurant at different tables. Then have one of us stand up and say, I think it's time for a little Jerusalem. And then we would all rise at our various tables throughout the entire restaurant. And then we would sing William Blake's Jerusalem.
Wow.
Which we did.
And did those feet in ancient time? Yeah. Did you start with verse one?
And did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountains?
This was at the pantry?
Yeah, loudly. We all stood up and belted it in our best Monty Python voices. And my favorite thing about it was that this old lady joined us.
She knew it.
And sang it with us. Fantastic. And then it was like a bunch of college guys trying to pull a prank in this, you know, 70-year-old woman who was moved by it. And there were some other people who sang along as well, but remained seated. And so we did a rousing, loud rendition of Jerusalem through this crowded restaurant. And anyway, that's the story. Well, you were looking for the lyrics. But yeah, so it's The Chariots of Fire comes from that Blake poem. Yeah.
Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire.
Yep.
Bring me my spear, O clouds unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire.
Yep. Yeah, yes.
It's pretty cool.
Bring me my chariot of fire.
As much as I dislike Blake, you got to admit.
He nailed that one. The Dark Satanic Mills is also a great line. But so anyway, the movie begins with that song being sung in a Christian church. This connects to another one of the musical themes that we see, which is his love of Gilbert and Sullivan.
Right.
And the reprisal of For He Is an Englishman.
Yeah.
You know, over and over and over again. And so it's, who is he? What is he? Like,
yeah.
Where is he? He really wants to be, like, more than anything, he wants to belong. He wants to be. He wants to fit. And at the same time, he's raging and fighting against everything that he can belong to. So he's...
Harold here.
Yeah.
Not Eric.
Harold. Yeah. And so he's thrusting himself into groups and clubs and this university. And he's trying to get all the way into the hallowed halls. But every time he's there, he's offended and he's insulted and he's angry and it's not enough and it's not satisfying. And he has to win. He must be there.
Yeah.
He's willing to push the edges of what was, propriety at the time in terms of having a trainer. He's really, really working the limits. And to try to win and try to matter. Parallel to him is this other guy who runs for completely different reasons.
Right.
And he goes into his own tortured dilemma of violating his conscience and not running to honor God, but running for himself. Like he'd just be running for himself. So that is, those twin tracks that just kind of weirdly, cross each other, and Harold loses to Little,
mm-hmm.
but then never gets his chance at revenge.
Yeah.
And so, he was supposed to go have this matchup, and Little's like, I'm not running because it's on the Sabbath. I won't do it. I'll go run this other race and I'm not even going to be up against you.
Right.
There's so much frustration and thwartation in that's just in the undercurrent.
Because Harold's theme is the take them on one by one and run them off their feet. Like he's like, I got to get them. And Little doesn't care at all. He got that awesome advice from his dad of run in God's name and let the world stand back and wonder. Like that's very cool. That parallelism drives.
But then you see the similarity in that Harold gets dragged into, you know, to meet with the dean or whatever. He gets dragged into the authority's office and they lean on him and they push on him to not have a trainer and not pursue excellence in this way.
Yeah.
Like, don't pursue winning at all costs. Don't do this. Don't try so hard. Don't be driven. And yet he is just that driven and he's going to do whatever it takes to run them off their feet one at a time. And these two people now become some of his enemies. They are his fans. They are his patrons, but now they're his enemies. Everybody becomes an enemy. And then you see Little getting pulled in to get chided by the chairman of the Olympic Committee and the Prince of Wales. And he also is defiant.
Yeah.
More
saying you gotta run the 200.
Yeah. He's more he's more cheerfully defiant, but they both get pulled in. They both show the same defiance of human authority.
Mm-hmm.
But for different reasons, you know, for completely different reasons from completely different places. And so they are these mirrors of each other, you know, opposite sides of the coin doing things for the, you know, different reason, but so similar in all these different pieces. Really fast, winning, defiant of authority, don't give a rip what anyone thinks.
Yeah.
But one of them actually does and is kind of consumed by this quest for validation. And the other one only needs the validation of doing what he's called to do.
Right.
So that collision course results in two victories for them at the Olympics. But then we close with this callback to the opening scene of this Christian funeral.
Yeah. It's fascinating to watch that play out. And okay, so when I was reading up on some of the views of this movie, I found a very interesting one by a rabbi who was clearly really bugged by this movie.
No doubt.
You know, and the take on this is basically the title is, I think, The Jew Who Ran Away. And he was complaining about the fact that he was watching the movie through an entire lens of Harold anglicizing in order to become, you know, because I think at the time Harold had even written an article in Real Life about how Jews could not be professional athletes if they kept the Sabbath. So it's very interesting to me that even down to that level, Harold as Abraham's was by converting to Christianity, he also was allowing himself to be able to run. Well, but there was a very interesting comparison because they were both talking about the Sabbath, right? And Little,
which is also not an accident that, you know, they don't jump up and down on it, but the fact that Jews are obviously very Sabbatarian and the Scots were also very Sabbatarian.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of parallels between
which country are we in? I mean, it kind of mattered as far as that was concerned. Yeah. But it's fascinating to watch him complain about that and think, you know what, I wish that Harold Abrahams had been as true as Little was to his beliefs, and just watching him have that backwards, right? So watching someone who has that be like, well, but actually one is correct. Like, and I thought I found that interesting.
It's not just being committed to conscience, because the thing is, Harold was as committed to his God as Little was, but his God was himself. He was chasing this hole in his soul, trying to fill it with validation. He was not burdened with conscience about running. Mm-hmm. He was from money, from success. He's not religious.
Yeah.
You know, he's like laughing about keeping kosher. You know, it's like, but we kind of see that he's keeping kosher.
Right.
Barely, you know, but we don't pick up in the story, at least in the film, that it matters to him a ton. It's just a joke on a date. But if he really cared about keeping kosher, he wouldn't be on that date. You know, it's like, if he really cared about purity, this isn't what he would be doing. And so there's, you know, he's doing all this. And the thing that's funny is we get to see Eric's hyper pious, very wrong sister.
That's what I was going to talk about, asking about watching him have to stick up.
And he has to navigate that. Yeah, he has to navigate that, where Harold is navigating intrusions onto his own identity, but he's already, and that's an interesting perspective from a rabbi, he's already compromised that identity.
Yeah.
He's already secular.
Yeah.
So Harold is a secular Jew and a little religious, you know, sort of socially religious. But we don't get, at least in the film, any real glimpse of him at synagogue, you know, keeping the Sabbath. We have one reference to not eating pork,
which is a great comedic moment.
I
was going to ask, it is interesting to respond, you know, where his sister comes Eric's sister comes and says, hey, you can't run. You missed a prayer meeting. It seems like you don't care about God anymore. And he's able to respond with, this is the way that God wants me to glorify him right now, which is a very faithful response too.
Yeah.
And it is interesting that for the rest of his life, he kept that same allegiance. It wasn't that he said, hey, this is how God wants me to glorify him to fit him. But then he went off and, you know, eventually died in Japanese occupied China, right? He was the whole way there. He was following that same mission.
Yeah.
Which, I was curious, what do you think the sister is just, I know I can't help but think in terms of emotional sabotage, where he's kind of going along and she's coming in and offering well-meaning and totally wrong-headed advice when he's on an important quest. I'm trying to wonder what her purpose is.
Let me just say a little practical application here.
No.
Everybody should have watched this movie. So to refer to the sister, you should all know what we're talking about. Imagine being an actress and being given a script. I'm like, hey, do you want to be this person?
Yeah.
And she did a good job executing. She did it well. But do you really want to be that character in the movie? I'm like, no. You're going to be the person who tries to get your Olympic class gold medalist talented brother to feel guilty about missing a prayer meeting.
Yeah.
Because he's training. You're going to be the one who's kind of hyper pious and scoldy and accusatory, accusing him of betraying God when it's actually that you feel betrayed personally. It's not a genuine belief that he's betraying God. It is entirely relational between herself and her brother and the loss of control. Mm. You know, and it is not genuine. There's nothing about that that's genuine. So she plays the character super well, but you read that part as an actress, you read a character like that as an actor, and you got to wonder, like, do I really want to be that?
Like, you weren't thinking it was going to be a villain role.
This is not fun. Like, I got to be that person. And then think about how many people volunteer for that job all the time. Mm. They're not even getting paid for it. They're just being that person in everybody else's life. And it's just awful. Just don't be that person.
Yeah. They're the person who comes in with the Jesus juke.
You're working too hard.
Right.
Like, why can't we have another date night? Mm. Why aren't you dating me anymore? Now that we're married and have three kids and you're working yourself to the bone and passing out, you know, trying to keep a roof over our heads. Just don't do it. Don't be that hyper pious guy in your, you know, dad or brothers or friends' life, and don't be that girl. It's just nasty. Confusing your own emotional sensitivities relationally to somebody else pushing hard, working hard, or growing or pursuing something,
right?
Confusing your own emotional hurt and neediness with the will of God is deadly.
It's also something a covenanter would totally know the difference between what's required by the Bible and what's not. You know,
what's there, like, on the page,
right? The prayer meeting, Hey, it's good to go to a prayer
meeting. It's not uncommon that people do this.
Yeah.
It just isn't uncommon at all that they confuse their own sensitivities for the, you know, the movement of the Holy Spirit. And it's not good.
Yeah. You know? And it's very interesting that Eric was able to defang that with a direct response to, you feel like this is, she says, I feel like you're leaving God behind. And he says, well, I feel like I'm pursuing God and putting him first.
Yeah.
And in that truth, it, you know.
I wish he just said, your feelings are liars. And just stop there.
Just quote the Jeremiah.
Yep. Instead of, and I do, it's one of the, it makes sense to me because there's a lot of sentimentality, even in the hard wooden Scott, you know, Sabbatarians. but he fights, he pushes against it with the same lever of personal feeling.
Yeah.
Which is not how you put that fire out. Mm. So it's
that's a good point.
Yeah. And you need to destabilize the authority of personal feelings right there. So as much as I like Little, this is the character, I don't care for If I was advising somebody in that situation, I would not advise them to pursue it that way. Don't talk about that. Don't concede the primacy of feelings. Just throw that away and point to the book.
So that when I run, I feel his pleasure is not the...
That's great.
That's good.
That's as a statement. That's just a testimony.
Right. Right.
So when I run, I feel his pleasure, but it's gotta be, an appeal to natural law and special revelation there, as opposed to my own feels.
Sure.
You have your feels. I have mine.
Yeah.
Like you can see how that gets us into a world of hurt down the road.
Yeah. It's like, and this is 1924.
How many conversations?
100 years ago.
How many conversations have gone that way? You have your feels. I have mine.
I mean, that is part of that question. I think a lot of people watching would be like, how come he couldn't just run on Sunday? You know?
Oh, he could have, but
yeah,
he absolutely could have, in terms of my actual theology of the Sabbath. However, I do think it would have been a profound mistake for him to have, because you shouldn't defy your conscience.
Right.
You know, it's like, if you're in a place where you actually do believe scripture teaches a thing, you better be doing it.
Right.
So,
right.
If you're reading the Bible and you have a conviction that this is what God said,
yeah,
then you better start obeying.
Yeah.
Until you figure out that no, he didn't say that.
Right.
You know, that's how you have to be. And so even if you're wrong, and it's actually not what God wants you to do, and he's going to laugh at you in heaven and he's going to say, that was silly. It's not what I asked you to do.
I gave you a different gold medal instead, but
you still should do it.
Right.
While like down on earth. Yeah. Now you should try to grow and mature and actually hopefully, you know, find the truth and find out if you're, you know, if your position's false. However, if your conscience is bound and you truly believe that God is instructing you not to do something, you better not contradict that.
Yeah.
You know,
Paul's really clear on that.
Yeah.
The food sacrifice
diet. Yeah, this is not tricky. This is not a tricky thing at all.
It's true that also the historical time frame for this, as running is becoming like kind of, this movie captures that moment when running became a national.
Yeah.
So really, you know, really picking off is like a big thing. Cause you know, the top four guys or whatever for England's all at Cambridge altogether, you know, it is not a small thing that it became something the prince was talking to him about, you know?
Right.
And so
national shame.
Yeah. So him taking that stand.
You're embarrassing all of us.
Right. Even him taking that stand, even though he's wrong, you know, there's a deeper right almost here where he's like,
and the Olympic committee chairman just states it overtly as like, it was country first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Then God, or king first. I don't remember how he says it. King your country first and then God. But it's, I think about one of the family stories we have about my dad's dad, who converted accidentally and miraculously at like a Naval Preparatory Academy on his way to the Naval Academy. But he becomes a Christian. He's a new Christian and he graduates from the Naval Academy and he becomes a pacifist. So on his very simple reading of scripture, and it's a very simple reading, it's not a real deep one. He becomes a pacifist. And he said the Navy didn't really take kindly to people deciding that they were pacifists after graduating from the Naval Academy. Mm-hmm. So he volunteered for the Far East so he would not ever see any action. And then as a result, he was the first of his class to arrive into the Korean conflict.
Oops.
And he still had this conviction and was on a destroyer and justified it to himself. He's like, well, I'm a communications officer. And then he got moved to gunnery officer and he kept getting moved all the way to the point where if one of the big guns was going to fire, like he was pulling the trigger. It was like he was sitting there going, boom.
So no longer a pacifist.
There was a guy moving his forefinger to wield death. And that was my grandfather.
That's funny.
You know, that he was in there.
Did he pursue the Bible study in more depth?
He did pursue the Bible study. And so as he was on the destroyer and he was a communications officer, and then this was happening, he got real serious about a Bible study. Like, I got to figure this out now. I can't I either have to get court-martialed or I need to actually, you know, do the deep dive. So he did the deep dive and read up and studied up and realized that his simple young Christian take had been foolish, and he started blowing stuff up with the clean conscience. But then immediately after that, he was, in his description, called to the ministry via like being miraculously saved during a mine blast and the sinking destroyer. And so he started preaching on one of the guns. He got up on one of the guns and began preaching to the crew and never stopped. And that was just,
yeah,
that was the rest of his life. So the journey, like the don't stand still. Don't just assume your bound conscience is correct. You do need to continue to grow, mature, and study. But if it is bound, you better abide by it.
Well, fantastic other movie, Private York, right? If you remember that one about the sniper in World War One.
Oh, yeah, Sergeant York.
Sergeant York, sorry, not Private. I'm mixing up here. Yeah. But he had the same thing where he was like, I'm a pacifist. I don't think it's okay for me to go shoot Germans. Yeah. And his commander said, hey, go take the weekend and read the Bible and like think about this. And even that example, he was able to come back with a clean conscience.
And then he did. And then he shot a lot of Germans. And then he shot a lot of them.
Shot a lot of Germans.
Yeah. It's
same thing with, I'm going to blame my sinuses, but the pacifist movie, in the
Hacksaw.
Yeah. Hacksaw Ridge. Yeah. Right. That's another example.
There can be a lot of courage.
Yep.
And self-sacrifice.
And also him being willing to pursue that commitment to what he believed without looking for the easy out.
Yep. Right.
And God making a way for him.
Yep. For sure. So it is, I mean, Chariots of Fire is a great film. It's a truly fantastic film. And it's one of those movies where you realize how much it's impacted culture in so many ways. But it's a really, really good one. I mean, it's just good.
I was thinking a couple instances of movie magic that they do really well when, you know, instead of running on Sunday, they have him give a sermon instead.
Yeah.
And on Isaiah 40, you know, they'll run and not grow weary, that passage. Yep.
And they also execute the race as well, you know, in terms of it's not easy to communicate the sensation and the stress of pre-race and intensity. And then when a race is so short,
right.
Like the way it was captured, the rerunning and Abrams, when he actually loses a race and just like the reliving, the replaying of it. And I'd say the edit, both the cinematography, the execution of the directing and the editing in the racing is fantastic. Mm. Especially the Olympic racing.
Yeah. Soundtrack won.
Yeah.
Won an Academy Award, which is funny.
It's great. It's like, you can listen to it and be like, it's actually so perfect. It's like, it's cheesy, but not.
Yeah.
You get into
and them running on the beach, you know, just.
Yep.
It's very simple, but also.
But sticky. It's one of those earworms. You know, it's one of those themes. It's not, there's not very many themes in the world for movies where you hear it and you just know the film. Mm. And it's one of them. It's up there. And normally when people achieve that, it's in kind of a commercial, hokey, you know, Indiana Jones, Star Wars kind of way, you know, where it's more heightened, farcical, and operatic. To do that in a best picture type movie.
Yeah.
In a drama. Right. In a human drama, and to have the sound signature be so distinctive is incredible. Mm. You know, that actually is pretty incredible.
It doesn't feel like they try to do that very often with Academy Award type pictures.
People try.
Do they try?
No composer ever sits down to score a movie and says, I hope this one's forgettable.
I think they're just trying too hard.
I really don't care if this one intrinsically comes to define my entire career. I'm just going to kind of phone this in. I'm sure they're tired sometimes. They don't pay attention, but no, they want the score to become one with the film and to mean the film and for the film to mean the score.
Yeah.
So
I guess I was just thinking the complexity, it seems like, in a lot of these movies. It feels like Chariots of Fire just went so simple and straightforward with that opening theme.
Oh, like the music?
Yeah. I guess that's what I'm.
But it's not really. I mean, it's melodic and it's simple, but it's on the synth. And it's on a synth for something that's happening way back in the past. So it's actually kind of this. It's an anachronistic choice.
Yeah.
And in the anachronism, it actually worked pretty well.
Yeah.
So it's odd to flash back to, you know, early 20th century and to do electronic.
Yeah.
You know, like that, but it worked. It really did work. Mm. But it does. It is kind of hopping where we're looking back at them from the present, and it gives you that feel. So it gives you the sensation of looking back into the past.
Yeah.
From somewhere else.
I can see that.
Yeah. And it's funny because if you bounce around just off the top of your head and you're like, man, what are the movie scores I could just identify?
I mean, Star Wars and Lord of the Rings.
Potter. I would not with Lord of the Rings.
Oh, really?
I wouldn't even know. But again, I mean, why would I?
We know, unfortunately, very
Jurassic
well.
Park. You'd recognize Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones. Yep. Mm-hmm. Star Wars. Yep. Home Alone. Yep.
Yeah.
There's probably some horror out there. You know, that it's actually like just as, you know, yeah, Hitchcocky.
Jaws.
Yeah, oh, right. Yeah. Jaws is there, which counts.
Right.
And then ask yourself right there, like, how many of those are already Spielberg or Spielberg influenced? But it's
right.
But there's, it's pretty fantastic. So everybody should watch it. You need to watch it. Mm-hmm. Do it. And then, I think the sports thing, and to tie off what I said earlier, you look at this story with Harold and Little, and you look at how sports exposes their flaws. Look at how competition, intense training exposes their flaws. It will not heal their flaws. It will not mend their flaws, but it can bring them to the surface. It can toughen you. It will make you stronger, mm-hmm. you know, and all that kind of stuff. But being stronger isn't just holier. You know, it's like that doesn't just make you holier, but it is like being richer. Like you have more, you have more to work with. You've been given more, you've earned more, but even that's not going to make you holier. But money will expose your flaws, right?
Yeah.
Like any kind of gain, any kind of advantage will expose your flaws. So if you compete and you refine, you get strong, you get tough, you get fast, you're beating other people, then you are growing as a character in many ways. But you can then use that growth to God's glory and faithfully or not.
Yeah.
And your character flaws, your Draymond Greening, your kicking, your whatever can be exposed.
Throat grabbing.
Yeah, it can be exposed or not. And so for Abrams, he kept thinking that going faster and winning would solve his character flaws. Mm-hmm. And he got all the way there and realized he still had them. And so the scene at the beginning and the end is just a discovery that he did resolve them. He did successfully have those flaws resolved. And then Little, like we see him have an external pressure and familial pressure, but those character issues are already resolved. Like they're already healed. They don't exist for him as active flaws, which is what Abrams envies, you know, in him. Mm. So with your raising your own kids or your own training or anything, just know that none of it by itself fixes something. All of it presents opportunities to identify and fix things, but none of it by itself will just,
I think we're still at
make that. You great.
They're trying to fundamentally discover the difference between the Sam Musubini style. Like we're going to time your strides. Mm-hmm. There's a big conflict between like the full amateur mode of like Little running like crazy with terrible form, just flailing everywhere.
Flopping around.
And then Musubini's like one of the very first running coaches to like time your stride and want to control everything about his athletes and refuse to be called a trainer. You know, like, I'm a coach, you know?
Yep.
I also love that his real name is Scipio Africanus Musubini, which is incredible.
Yeah.
So,
and the fact that it's the Jew and the Arab versus the world.
Yeah.
Is a fun little,
there's a lot of themes there. It made me wonder. Yeah. I mean, it still feels like we like to think about our sports like amateurs.
Oh yeah.
Like we would like our athletes to be amateurs, even though we want them to perform like pros. I don't know. That to me is something it feels like we still kid ourselves on a bit.
Well, if you took the one athlete that's a great combination, if you took Steph Curry and you took away his playfulness and his happiness and his like the presentation of joy, which is what Little had, mm-hmm. Steph plays with that kind of like just joy of the game, love of the game, and you know, thrilled to be alive. He really does play with that. However, he is putting in insane work. He's putting in insane work. And then, you know, it looks like the other. But if he were to show up and have a storm cloud face and always be you know, and always be deadly serious, trying to look intimidating.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be anywhere near as well liked. Like it is this little brand.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
Joy and pleasure in what he's doing. The you know, the thrill of what he's doing and how playful he is, how amateurish he is in that. In his childish.
Sure, demeanor. Even shooting funny shots and warm-ups and,
yeah.
and all that
it's
stuff.
It's so yeah. playful and childish and amateurish there, but it's the fruit of absolute insane professionalism. And I think he's such a great combination of the two. Mm. So there's other very happy guys out there, but I don't think anybody has the rep for being as sunny and happy and optimistic as
well. I think it kind of makes sense of them choking on the 3-1 too after Draymond gets suspended. You know, the 3-1 lead, because you watch them all get so nervous and sad.
Yeah. And tension, frustration.
And then lose 3 games in a row, right?
Yep.
That's good. Yep. That's an interesting point.
So anyway, I think he's sort of a picture of what Little was at his time.
Mm.
Okay. And Little probably wasn't just spazzing out in the Highlands in boots and pants.
Right.
As much as
that's the big movie. Same thing with Harold. They go ahead and set up as if he said goodbye to his girlfriend and then went and did all the running and then came back and found her. Two different girls in real life. They're not, you know, but that's fine. That's how we tell stories. It was not fine.
We judge it strongly. However, that's called adaptation.
Right. And Abrams gets, you know, I think, you know, you read articles about this. They're like, oh, he's oppressed and a member of a subclass. But I mean, he'd already run in the Olympics before. This was his second Olympics that he'd run in. And, you know, I just find it interesting that it does seem to me we want
and sometimes,
this.
Sometimes that's perfectly infuriating.
Yeah.
So I we'll talk about Boys in the Boat, but Boys in the Boat's the biggest example of how to truly pooch it in adaptation.
Okay.
Those adaptation moments that you're describing in Chariots of Fire, like, oh, we combined two girls into one girl. Great.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about the fact that this was
he's Abrams already made it. He's
second
already.
Time.
Yeah.
We're just talking about this one specifically in this little fight. We're not saying that he's never been before.
Yeah, not lying.
But we're also just not, you know, getting into it. Like those adaptation decisions aren't big deals. You know, those are the kind of things where you find out more later. So if you watch Ford versus Ferrari and you watch the 24-hour war. So if you watch the 24-hour war, which is this great documentary about that car race, you realize like, oh, this was years and they've compressed it down into one, you know, one movement for purposes of the entertainment version of this. Yeah. Like it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's inspired by, it's based on, everybody knows.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it works. Hoosiers is inspired by, you know, a true story. Why they changed as much as they did is probably so they didn't have to pay life rights to people. Mm. You know, they changed the years. They did, you know, they moved the year 3 years. They do these different things, but there is a tiny little school and really did this. Like this is, you know, this is what happened. So there's a lot of different reasons why you could have to change details. Some of it's for three act efficiency. Some of it's just for audience clarity. Some of it's for likability.
Yeah.
So if we tried, like, think of it this way, it took a lot of time. It took a long time. If Harold broke up with his girlfriend and found a new girl, we would all dislike him.
Yeah.
The likability's lost. The relatability's lost because it's such a compressed timeline in a film. Right. So over a year, we might be concerned. We might tell him like, it's a little fast, dude. This doesn't seem great.
Yeah.
We might have issues with it, but compress it into an hour and 45 minutes and it looks real bad.
We don't forgive him. Yeah. Even though it's 10 years in real life.
Yeah. You know? So it snaps. Yeah. It can snap likability. It can snap relatability. And so like, you know what? Let's not distract the audience with that. Because we don't have enough time to tell the rhythm of his breakup and his meeting of the new girl in this
plus
frame.
The girl he found and married was a Gilbert and Sullivan star. So it totally makes sense that she should have been earlier. The vibe was earlier.
Yeah, they smashed it and adjusted it. But that makes sense to me. It makes a lot of sense to me because if you stuck with the real, and then you try to compress the timeline, you're not sticking with the real. You're compressing the timeline. So the adaptation of forced timeline, tell me the whole story in 90 minutes. Like, yeah, you could need to do that.
Yeah,
it's not a big deal. Because otherwise you're actually lying about him to the audience by sticking with the exact truth. because you're making the audience dislike him and not relate to him in a way that would not have been the case if they were experiencing it real time.
Yeah. One of the guys was telling me about that, a Robert Frost bio where the biographer wrote down literally everything they could remember in several volumes and made everybody think Frost is a maniac because they took every detail they possibly could instead of reducing and telling the truth, which is, I think, the point you're making.
Yeah. So reduction, impressionism, it's much more important to receive the actual sensation and impression of the real than it is to have the datum.
Yeah. On this afternoon, Frost was very upset about this.
You know,
which does make him sound like a pedantic maniac. Yes,
and especially when you do it 47 times. Right. So anyway, it's a great film. I hope everybody enjoys it. I hope your kids enjoy it. And do use training and sports in your own life. Do it. But don't feel holier just because you just worked out. Mm. It doesn't, you know, it didn't get you closer to heaven.
Twitter bros hardest hit.
You're not holier until you're posing in front of the mirror with a camera. That's maximum holiness. Mm-hmm. And with preferably that, with oil and then post it.
But not seed oils.
As long as it's not seed oils, then you're extra pious.
Good.
So get out of the tanning bed, oil up, post on social. Now you're holy.
And with that,
that's called sarcasm.
We break.
See ya.
Hey, Christian Dad. Are you paying a monthly fee to let Hollywood producers pump their septic tanks directly into your living room? Even worse, directly into your imagination and the imaginations of your children. How much darkness streams into your home every day, every week? Have you gotten too used to turning your mind off when you put your feet up? Have you invited your own enemies into your home? How much damage has already been done to you and to your family?
My heart says that the way I feel most myself is to go by the name Fred. That's because I'm non-binary.
Canon Plus is building a global platform with one simple goal: to create and deliver great content that will help Christian families grow stronger and more dangerous in the world. Content that will kick your brain's butt and help you bear down and step up. Content that will encourage, equip, educate, challenge, and inspire your family. Content built on the bedrock of real truth, real goodness, not fake trendy virtues.
How dare you!
And real, lasting beauty. Your family might already be struggling. Maybe the man of the house has been sipping too much Bud Light Gospel in the basement for too long.
It's day 6 of girlhood!
But it's not too late. With thousands of audiobooks, podcasts, truth-telling documentaries, and curriculum for all ages, Canon Plus wants to help you grow stronger together with your family. There might be enemies at the gates, but there's a feast on the table to strengthen you for the fight. We want the resources we produce to help you do the real work of cultural change, becoming a lighthouse in your own community. Armed with courageous joy and a faith that burns hot and bright, especially when the world would rather keep you on a cute little dimmer switch. We don't have to wallow in the world's filth.
Moonlight, best picture.
You are gay.
We don't need to let our strength atrophy like numbed victims of some ungodly matrix, leaving our families unprotected and vulnerable. It's time for Christian fathers to stop being such cultural cuckolds. Well-behaved Wonderbread winners sitting by and paying for the world to assault their families with lies. Let's get strong and grow our families strong. Let's raise our kids to be the world's worst nightmares. Smart, secure, fearless, joyful, difficult to control, and quick to laugh at lies and nonsense. We're pushing back against the rising tide of sewage on our screens. We're pumping out antidotes to the world's poisons. But we can't do it alone. We need allies. You need allies. So consider this your invitation to join up and make things a little awkward for all our weaker brethren in church leadership.
It's not that we're against anything.
Who so badly want to be worldly cool kids. Help us build a streaming platform unlike any other. A platform that will challenge and strengthen Christians, mind, body, and soul. Until this cultural tide begins to turn.
She's dreaming about becoming the leader she knows she can be.
And yes, this tide will turn. This ain't the Alamo. We're all gonna die, but we have no intention of losing. Canon Plus. You don't have to subscribe, but you do have to stop sucking.